So back in October of 2018, my wife and I, we're having a average normal pregnancy. Everything that seemed to be going really well. And, on the 13th into the 14th, something really strange happened where, we wound up learning, while we were sitting in triage that her water had broken, and it was only 21 weeks into the pregnancy. And for anybody that knows about a pregnancy that would, have a water break at that stage, there's a lot of, really concerning things, to consider. One being that the baby's not viable at that stage. And, you have to wait until about 23 weeks for the consideration of medical intervention with a child at that age. So they also tell you that there's a very small chance that you're going to last more than 24 hours keeping the pregnancy. And they give you three choices. One, terminate the pregnancy. Two, you can let nature take its course. Three, introduce an antibiotic and a week later, steroid, hoping that this will help to introduce like some lung function to the baby that's otherwise not going to develop throughout the rest of the pregnancy, no matter how long they stay in, because that is something that helps the baby breathe. So we spent about 12 or so hours in triage considering every single option, and I know that there's a lot that can go into a decision like that. I think the value that we probably held on to most was life and not giving up and determination. And they don't really let people into that triage area, but thankfully we had a nurse that allowed our mothers to join us, and we were pushed by medical staff to make a decision because we were really ambivalent. And the decision we made was to do the antibiotic. And we were fortunate that Aubrey is my daughter's name. She stayed in for 7 more weeks. My wife's name's Amy. She held on to the pregnancy 2 weeks at home, because there's nothing they can do with medical intervention other than deliver. And she then spent 5 more weeks in the hospital, which was really hard time for her. Imagine not going anywhere other than a hospital room and maybe just walking around the unit. So there was a lot of decisions ahead for us. We knew that we were going to wind up in the NICU. That was our best shot. Some people are there by surprise, and that can be really hard. We knew our best shot was there. But decisions started right away for us. And I can say that the trajectory of the decisions went from ACP, to now things, because she is with us. They are decisions that people are making in advanced care, but more decisions of life for her and how she could get to a place of quality of life. So the first decision was on the night that she was born, they told us that she was doing really well, her Apgar scores were good, and an hour later came into our hospital room and said, "We're trying everything, and our last effort is with this intervention," which was to put in a chest tube. And it's actually a moment that my wife forgets ever happening. So I remember saying to my wife, we have to get some rest. It's the middle of the night. We don't know what we're going to be faced with in the morning. And fortunately, it was a visit with her. We weren't able to hold her, and probably not for another week were we able to hold her. But she made it through the first tough decision. After that, there were other decisions to be made. First, you had to be in rounds every day with doctors deciding what interventions they may be trying. One doctor, he would often say, if things were going well for the day, that your child's boring. It was his way of kind of introducing humor. And so the next big decision was that she wasn't coming off of oxygen support. She went from a ventilator to CPAP, and she got stuck on CPAP. And they wound up eventually saying to us, "We're going to have to do some further intervention because we're concerned about the length of time that she's on this form of support. So I won't get into the specifics, but it's something called the DAR protocol, and the trade-offs that you have to consider are that it can introduce developmental disorders in children. In history, that's what it had done, and they had been practicing it differently, almost experimentally, to help kids get off of support. And we were very fortunate that it did work. It got her to just oxygen with a small amount of pressure that she eventually came home on. And we actually just recently, she's now 16 months old and just came off of oxygen, you know, the beginning of March. So it was a slow taper where she was on it for 24 hours a day for a period of time. And then she got to the point where it was just during sleep, to nothing. We're very fortunate that we're in that place. And I mentioned that the decisions are getting less ACP, like, and more into, like how she'll thrive, and she still has a feeding tube. A lot of babies have issues with feeding, suck, swallow, breathe, in particular in this situation, and they have to learn that, and it's such a slow process. So, you know, these decisions are decisions that are so hard. I should have mentioned in the beginning that my wife is a nurse. So she always carries that medical side, and she would tell you that it's a burden as much as it's a blessing to know. So when we would decide on things, a lot of times there was some division in our decision making for sure. And we really had to talk about the trade-offs and the hard decisions that would come. We're happy that today that when we make those decisions, it's more like, you know, what kinds of things can we do to help make this a pleasant eating experience so that, you know, at some point or another, she'll make this transition off of a feeding tube. And we don't know how long that'll be. Everyone asks us, and it's more like we don't know. The beginning parts of this, though, are such a hard experience to go through. I think when you're, like, faced with these decisions in a crisis, it's the worst timing, like, and no one really can be prepared for stuff like this. You can't really anticipate. I have to say the experience of the doctors in the NICU being able to, like, walk us through us making decisions, not being pushy when it didn't have to be right away. And sometimes they would own those decisions just because she's a baby and that they have to intervene. Happy to say that she's with us right now, and, I'm going to share a screen with you guys so you can get a opportunity to see. What she looks like. This is her Easter picture. I thought about a million different pictures I want to show you, and I chose not to scare you with what it looks like to be on artificial support as a baby, because you should only have to see that if you have to go through it, really.
She's beautiful. Thank you so much for sharing that with us, Stephen. I know that, like you mentioned, it's not something you can ever really prepare for. I'm wondering for you and your experience, like, what was the biggest difference from an ACP perspective, like, when you're dealing with pediatric doctors versus, like, regular doctors? Like, what was that like?
Well, I have to say I was very fortunate. My wife always says this, that, like, she works at CHOP, and most people would ask, are you at CHOP? And we would be like, no. Actually, for babies that have maybe had to have a surgery post NICU stay, we were actually at a smaller hospital. And the culture that had been built, you talk about culture in an organization, they knew how to care for a family holistically. And they really, like, responded to that so well. they knew what parents were going through. Weird thing they'll say is that nurses have something called a nurse curse, where often nurses had experienced really traumatic pregnancies as well. So some of them being in that NICU and being cared for by friends, really. So I would say that NICU was particularly special, and we also had to go to CHOP actually for like a respiratory virus that most kids probably would just pass over. It went up in a 3-week stay, and it was scary because I think even in pediatrics, if you stepped outside of the NICU, there's like lost like empathy and understanding for what it's like to be a parent going through this, even in a specialized as children's hospital.
Yeah, and I heard you mention that it was a lot about trade-offs, and I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about that, like what you mean by trade-offs.
Yeah, I think the one that really sticks in my mind is the DAR protocol decision, because we knew she was developing well, like from a standpoint of they were doing like neuro assessments on her, and she never had a brain bleed, which is very fortunate given the prematurity level. We were in the 4 months.
Okay.
And so we felt like we might be like really putting her at a deficit by making that decision. And they actually called off on it a while. They brought it to us, and we kind of said no first.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we realized how long she had stayed, and some of the trade-offs about being on oxygen could be like blindness, there's retinopathy, premature, that can be an issue. Mm-hmm. So you have to make a decision like, do I want my child to be blind, do I take the trade-off of like developmental issues? And fortunately, like where we're at right now is that she's well, and she's catching up in many areas, but cognitively doing very well. And I think like it validates that we made the right decision, but I could not even imagine. And then the other trade-off decision was, when considering what to do with the pregnancy, they pretty much tell you that you really have to think about your family planning. Like, are you young enough and you want to have enough children? This may be hard. You could be tackling something that of an experience as a parent where you're really providing a lot of support to a child that has so many needs. I think to myself, what if we leaned another way? What if we terminated that pregnancy in hopes of some other experience? Like right now, I sit in a place where I can easily say that would have been a horrible decision because of where we're at.
Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing, Stephen. I appreciate it. And last but not least, we want to also transition to our final speaker, Tracy Brubaker.
Hi. So the phone, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. So the phone rang for me at 2 a.m. on a cold March night. And on the other end of the line was my oldest sister. She told me that my father was on his way to the hospital and that he'd fallen in the driveway in the middle of the night. And he was unable to get up or reach his cell phone. And so he laid on the driveway for a few hours. Earlier in the evening, my dad had gone to celebrate St. Patrick's Day at his brother's house, which was just a half a mile away from where he lived. He was a very quiet man of a few words, and he lived alone, but he enjoyed spending time with his brother. And that night, one of our relatives thought it was a good idea to drive him home. And to this day, we're not quite sure if he ever actually made it into the house, but he did make it into his driveway. This was 2015, and my dad was 80 years old. So this is where my unexpected journey as a caregiver began. Initially, as a caregiver, my goal was to support and relieve my oldest sister. She happened to be the person that my father called regularly for help, and my father and I did not share that same kind of relationship. He had had a few hospitalizations the year before, accidents around his home where he would pass out and fall, sometimes for hours, be passed out, and then usually come away with broken bones. And my sisters and I understood that my father's drinking provoked a lot of these accidents. At the same time, though, the hospital visits revealed to us that he had an underlying and deteriorating heart condition. So my 600-mile round trips to see him became more frequent. And if I was going to be totally honest, they were awkward for me. I was struggling to make sense of his choices. Anyways, he became progressively more sick. And what it stirred up for me was just childhood stuff. Feeling responsible, feeling guilty, feeling ashamed. And for me, I didn't know my dad well enough to know what he would want or how to care for him. And in my family, we don't speak about those things. We don't speak about mental health. He didn't speak about physical illness much at all. And so let's be clear. I know my dad loved me and was proud of me, but I had sort of come to terms as an adult that I wasn't always going to be involved in his life at a very connected level. Some background on him. At age 9, he contracted spinal meningitis as a child and was very ill, was bedridden for a year. It left him with some cognitive impairments. His mom also was ill at that time. And these childhood experiences developed in my dad a real fear of doctors. It's something he called white coat syndrome. So for his whole entire life, I don't ever remember him going to the doctor. He left high school in the 9th grade and after a brief stint in the Army, became a maintenance worker at Xerox, where he worked for nearly 30 years. He was a really hard worker and a good provider to our family, but he did very much struggle with alcoholism. My dad had 3 girls. I'm the middle child, and my sisters and I, as we became adults, grew much closer. And we each have had a different role in his care. When my dad, in 2015, when my dad fell in the driveway, I was literally just preparing to start my career at Vital Decisions. And so up to that point, if I was going to be honest, I had let the demands of my prior role, an executive role in another organization, sort of took precedence in my life. And so my sister had carried a lot of the weight of my father's care. So hard. Wow. But the universe had it that I was supposed to work at Vital Decisions and that I had this time off in between. And so I got to engage with my family and with my dad in a whole new way. My dad was very sick, and his underlying health conditions were pretty severe. So he spent several weeks in the hospital, several weeks in skilled nursing, and then he still wasn't able to take care of himself. So we transitioned him to assisted living, which, if you knew him, was a very tough decision. Independent, German, strong-headed, stubborn man. But he was so ill that he did not fight that, and he did allow us to put his home up for sale. And so that summer, I got to spend a lot of time driving back and forth to Rochester. And personally, I packed up my dad's home on my own, which was a home that I actually had not entered very frequently, had not spent a lot of time there. And in the process, I discovered that he had a broken hot water heater. So he had lived without hot water for some time. His cupboards were bare, and his home was in disrepair. So I recognized myself at that time as a daughter. I felt heartbroken and a lot of guilt and shame again. At that time, my sisters and I worked with a lawyer to establish a power of attorney and to sell my father's home. And in the process, the lawyer had my father complete an advance directive. And I guess one thing I just wanted to say about that was I very much remember that conversation. Again, this was like right around the time as I was first starting Vital. And the lawyer basically said, you're never going to need this, but just in case, you should have it. And you should indicate what kinds of life support you would want if something like really, you know, terrible happened, but it's never going to happen, as if none of us die. The one thing my dad said was that he would never want to be a vegetable. And so to, you know, give him as much care as he needed, unless there was no hope of him recovering. And this was actually the first time I actually ever heard my dad talk about his end of life wishes. But it was the beginning of a new chapter from my father and I. In 2015, my dad's cardiologist told us that if he kept drinking, he would surely die within a year. But if he stopped, he might have 2 to 5 years to live. And because ultimatums had been ineffective for him in the past, we didn't have a lot of hope there. But what we did was my sisters and I began to talk with my dad about what he wanted and what he did not want. This was the first time this really started to happen for us. Surprisingly, after drinking for more than 70 years, my father privately, without making declaration to us, decided to stop drinking and has actually been sober for about 3 years. In the years that followed after this accident in 2015, there's been countless hospitalizations as his heart weakens from congestive heart failure and other health issues. He's had heart attacks, dizzy spells, he's fallen, broken bones, lots of shortness of breath. He's got a very compromised immune system. He's had strokes. He's had stents placed in his heart, electric shock, meds to manage a fibrillation. He takes more than 20 pills a day. He's had heart valve surgery. And through all of this, what's worried him the most is his the money that he worked so hard for 30 years to save up for himself. He's watched it dwindle very quickly, and that worries him a lot. In terms of caregiving, my sisters and I have approached this as a partnership, and we take different roles. So I do things like manage his finances. I make trips for doctor visits when we need an advocate or there's more information needed. I tend to be the person who orders medical supplies and household needs. I'll get groceries from time to time. And I've even had to shower my dad. I provide respite care for my sister, who's more than once used up every single hour of sick time to take care of him. We try to be in this together. The most meaningful part for me of being a caregiver has been keeping my dad company and listening to his stories and his worries and his needs and reassuring him that we'll take good care of him. And we have talked about the kind of care that he would want and would not want if his heart were to stop. And I think it's important for people to know these actually are not easy conversations, and they're not very fluid or pretty or magical. They're difficult. They're awkward. We stumble. And sometimes it feels like he doesn't really understand how sick he is or what might happen when his heart stops. Right before a heart valve procedure, my sister and he worked with his primary care physician to complete a MOLST, which is a medical order for life-sustaining treatment. And while he was recovering from that surgery for a heart valve procedure, my sisters and I were with him, and we experienced him having a stroke in front of us. And it was, you know, one of these moments I'll never forget, where my sisters kind of broke down, screaming, crying, and this calm came over me, and I pulled every vital decisions specialist next to me and around me, and I just was really calm, and I was able to talk with the doctors and talk about what I was really clear about what my dad wanted and what he didn't, and they were able to intervene, and he lived through that. But it was a really poignant moment for me, and one that I know vital decisions helped me to be prepared for, and all the conversations with my dad and sisters. So in closing, I would just say that I'm very certain my dad is in the end stages of heart disease. last month or February, he was hospitalized again for symptoms of stroke and respiratory issues caused by heart failure. And he was very, very sick. I've never seen him sicker. And we were at one of the best teaching hospitals in Rochester. And he was on oxygen, and I asked for a palliative care consult. And I thought I would just share the story because the response that I received from the hospital was really unexpected. Basically, the doctor looked at me, was exasperated, and said, you know, that's for the very end of life. Like, why would you need that? And I had to put on my advocacy hat and just share that I was not sure that my dad understood what was happening to his body, that I was afraid that I needed some emotional support, and I wanted someone to help just review what might be happening and what interventions he may have to decide on. The doctor didn't really understand, but eventually did provide a palliative nurse practitioner who came. And it was the most beautiful thing. It's funny because earlier in his stay, a team of neurologists had showed up into his room, and there was five doctors, probably two docs and three residents, and they all had white coats. They stood over my dad, and they were talking to him a mile a minute in language I know he didn't understand, basically telling him that he had clogged carotid artery and that he might have to have surgery. So I had to translate for him. He said, absolutely not. I'm not doing any surgery. I just want to go home. And so it was after that that the palliative nurse came. And it's just powerful because she sat down right next to him. She held his hand. She looked at him in the eye. And she got to know him as a person, which was really touching. Talked to him about his career and made him feel important. Made him feel important for his service in the Army. It was really powerful and a gift to me. And she encouraged him to be very specific with me and my sisters about what he would want as his heart begins to slow down. So in closing, I know we're running out of time. I just wanted to share that. Through all of this, I experience a lot of gratitude for my dad, and it's given me an opportunity to enter into his life, to make peace with our past, to be the caregiver, the daughter that I want to be for him, and to receive receive love from him, which is, it's maybe kind of an oxymoron. But his serious illness has offered that, and it's allowed me to let go and to just fully embrace who he's become over the last few years. And it's just been a joy to be able to honor his wishes and to get really clear about what matters most to him. Simple little things matter most to him: maintaining his privacy, having his little routine in his apartment, keeping good care of his things. Getting to see some sunshine out the window. So as a caregiver, I get to make sure that those things that really matter to him continue. So anyway, thank you.